All right, how you guys doing? Come on in, sit down and relax, put in your fancy iPhone earbuds. You're about to listen to Let's Talk Iran and Stuff, a podcast about all things Iran related and pretty much anything else I find to be particularly interesting. I'm your host. My name is Reza Manashi. I'm an Iranian American. I'm a lovable jerk. I'm a zoo enthusiast. And most importantly, I'm the research director at the National Iranian American Council. I'm sitting here live in my office in Washington, D.C., and before we go any further, make sure to check out and support NIAC at www.niacouncil.org, and you can also check us out on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Google or any online platform of your choosing. Full disclosure here, folks. I've never hosted a podcast before. This is my first time doing anything like this, but in my eternal quest to give knowledge to the people, I'm going to hit up as many friends and colleagues as I can to share their expertise with you about all things Iran-related. NIAC used to have a podcast 3 or 4 years ago. Shout out to Nobar Elmi and Lily Samini. And I'm here to revive it and build off what they created. So my proposition to you is this. Let's grow together. Like a fine wine, this podcast will only get better with age. So if you keep listening, I'll keep providing you with top-notch content that is free of the typical Washington, D.C. spin, and that's a Reza Manashi promise. Well, my guest this week is Eric Ferrari. He's the founder and principal of Ferrari & Associates, a law firm that provides expert legal representation in U.S. economic and trade sanctions matters under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, also known as OFAC. In my humble opinion, you won't find a better sanctions lawyer in the business, and you should hire him for all of your lawyerly needs. Eric and I talked about sanctions after the nuclear deal, the pros and cons of sanctions as a foreign policy tool, his top five MCs in hip-hop, and a whole lot more. I think you're going to like it a lot, I think you're going to learn a lot, and much respect to Eric for agreeing to be my first guest. So, without further ado, enjoy the show. I think this thing is on. We're good. Look, I appreciate you taking the time and coming out and chatting because you're the first. So you're my guinea pig. We're learning together.
Yeah.
My learning curve is probably a lot more steep because I'm sure you've done this kind of stuff a lot more than I have. But we want to inform the people. We want to give knowledge to the people. That is the premise behind this. But we start off with the song, and you chose Big Pun off the books, which I think is awesome. But explain to me why you chose Big Pun off the books and what stands out to you about that particular song.
Well, one, rest in peace, Christopher Rios, Big Pun. One, it's a banger, so it's a good song.
Absolutely.
And then two, off the books I feel is appropriate for this discussion because I imagine at some point we're going to be discussing sanctions.
Yes, we are.
And there's a lot of authorities on the books.
Yes.
But the true story is actually happening off the books, both in relation to how sanctions are implemented, how people circumvent sanctions, and to what the practical effect of sanctions are. So
yeah.
Really the title applies to the topic of discussion here today.
There's no doubt about that. I like the double entendre, if you will.
Yeah.
I think Big Pun's a dope MC. I absolutely do. Definitely rest in peace. Died too soon. Most people only know, like, I'm not a player. I just crushed a lot. They know the radio cuts. They don't know, you know, Deep Cover, what was it, 98?
Yeah.
Deep Cover 98. They don't know a lot of the stuff that he was doing before the radio jams came up. So I very much appreciate. Same with Fat Joe. They don't know the fact that Fat Joe was digging in the crates and all that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back, Fat Joe has been at every period of hip-hop, like an integral piece. I think a lot of people just remember Lean Back and the Terror Squad stuff, but yeah, Fat Joe has been absolutely, you know, a centerpiece of hip-hop for decades now.
Yes, discreetly, yet very much having a presence.
That's right.
But so you chose Big Pun, and something that I want to ask you, because like me, you are a hip-hop aficionado. Like, your knowledge of hip-hop is very good. I don't know if the people know that, but I know that. So I want the people to know that you're not a one-trick pony. You're not just a sanctions expert. top five MCs.
Oh, come on.
It can change from day to day.
It's an impossible question. I mean, where do we even start?
Where do we start?
I'm not putting these in order.
No, in no particular
order. I'm not going to put these in order.
In no particular order.
And this is my list. This is probably not going to be universal. Of course it's not going to be universal, but
yeah.
I've got to go with Pac and Big,
of course.
All right, let's just get that out of the way. I'll put Jay-Z on there.
Really?
And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'll tell you why I put Jay-Z on there. Not just because of his skills as an MC, but because of what he's contributed, what he has built. He's done it for decades.
Yeah, he's not a businessman. He's a businessman.
Yeah, and by the way, Reasonable Doubt is still an album I can put on today, and it sounds new to me. It's so good.
Yeah, front to back. Dope album.
Big L.
Yeah, I like that.
And then this is one that's going to throw a lot of people for a loop.
Yeah.
But Styles P.
The Ghost,
The Ghost. And so Styles P is someone who I've always just thought was incredible. But I almost feel like he gets overlooked because Jadakiss is so good, too.
That's right.
But Styles P. So those are my five. Pac and Big, Big L, the Jigga Man, and Styles P. That's who I go with. Top five.
So a couple of questions.
Sure.
First and foremost, Nas didn't make the cut. Why?
Listen, Nas, again, this is why I don't like to play this game. Nas is incredible. Illmatic is another album on par with, if not better than Reasonable Doubt. I just don't feel that Nas, for me personally, he hasn't had the impact on my life. I don't want to say he hasn't had the impact on the game, because he's definitely had an impact on the game. With the exception of Illmatic, which is an album I still listen to at least once a month, he just hasn't had the same impact on me personally. So, but Nas, you could definitely put Nas in there. You could definitely put Redman in there. Actually, I may have to take someone off and put Redman back on. But I mean, there's so many people that were just incredible artists.
No, it's tough. I understand that. Yeah. And I begrudgingly acknowledge your point about Nas. Nas would be in my top five, but after it was written, it got a little murky.
And so, that's really where I was going with it.
Yeah, so I understand.
But he came back with Ether, never stopped.
Exactly. It's not that it wasn't in him. It was just, you know, the jiggy, shiny suit period got him, I think, a little bit. But Big L was on there, which is awesome, because I feel a lot of people slept on Big L. Lifestyles of the Poor and Dangerous was dope. The Big Picture was dope. And you're hard-pressed to find a better freestyler than Big L. His freestyles were better than a lot of the cuts that he had on his album. Because we use language that the children are able to listen to on this podcast.
Right.
I can't recite some of my favorite Big L lines.
I was just thinking of a line myself, and I was like, I don't think I can say that.
Exactly.
Here.
Big L, and most people don't know, Big L was about to sign to Rockefeller Records when he was unfortunately gunned down on the mean streets of New York.
That's a sad thing, because three of those five I mentioned all passed away.
So. That's right. And then
From gun violence.
Yeah, well, hip-hop's got a little bit better when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
A little bit better.
A little bit.
You don't see as many prominent guys getting gunned down.
No, it's usually the smaller guys.
Yeah. But then the fifth one that I wanted to ask you about, Big L, who was the other one? Fat Joe. Did we talk about Fat Joe?
We talked about Fat Joe, but he wasn't in my top five.
He wasn't in the top five. So who was the one that you mentioned that we haven't talked about yet?
We talked about Pac, Big, Jay-Z, Big L. And Styles P.
Styles P. Okay. So this is what the interesting thing about Styles P and just the locks more generally is most people don't know. Most people outside of New York City don't know how dope the locks were before they signed a Bad Boy.
Oh, yeah.
And they came out with Money, Power, Respect that had some dope cuts, but then it got jiggy because Puffy got his hands on it.
Yeah.
Then he went to Rough Riders and they dropped the album they probably wanted to drop.
Right.
We Are the Streets, which was a fantastic album. But then Styles P started to come out with all these mixtapes that most people don't know.
Yep.
And that's when I really learned that Styles P was on par with Jadakiss, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, that's when you really started to see separation, when the mixtapes started coming out in the early 2000s, the mid-2000s, if you followed that whole scene.
Yeah.
And then you were really checking for Styles P, because Styles P had, like, the best mixtapes you would find.
Absolutely.
Like,
I still listen to, I can't remember which one, it was a Ghost Stories Volume 2 or 3. I still listen to that.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I still listen to that. So it's a great top five. I enjoy that top five. Now, you know, we started off by talking about Big Pun, Off the Books, dope song. People got a chance to listen to a little slice of it. Go check out that song and his entire catalog. Rest in peace, Big Pun. And we talked about your top five MCs. But like you said, Off the Books is...
got the double entendre. It also is very relevant to what we're really bringing you here to discuss, your other area of expertise, which is the sanctions. But before we dive into the actual nuts and bolts, give the people a little bit of a backstory. Let them know how you got into the game. How did you become, in my opinion, one of the best sanctions lawyers in the game doing it today?
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. My career with sanctions really started back right around 9/11.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to be an IP lawyer, intellectual property. And I had an opportunity to go to Santa Clara out in the Bay Area, but I got a scholarship to go to St. Mary's University School of Law in Texas. And the reason I chose to go there is, one, I have a lot of friends in Texas, but two, they had just opened up the Center for Terrorism Law. And so me being half Iranian, growing up in a household where opinions on foreign policy and international relations were often and frequently stated and discussed. You know, and I'm sure you can relate to this being Iranian in America. You know, we have a very strong interest in foreign policy and international relations.
Yes, we do.
And people have very strong opinions on that. So I went, I took the scholarship, I took the money, and I went down to San Antonio, and I eventually became a research fellow at the Center for Terrorism Law. Thank you to my former boss, Jeff Atticott, for giving me that opportunity. But I realized very early on I was either going to have to defend Guantanamo Bay detainees, or I was going to have to join the military.
Yeah.
My mom is an ardent pacifist. There was no way I was going to be allowed to go into the military, even though my dad did serve in the Air Force and really wanted me to go into the military.
Respect to mom.
Yeah. Well, you know, we call my mom Team Sar.
Yeah,
because she's the actual general, like she runs the family. But I didn't want to defend Guantanamo Bay detainees, and really there wasn't room for me to do it anyways, because so many other people were doing that. National security lawyers were doing that.
Yeah.
And then one day I was reading a case, I believe it was Holy Land Foundation v. Ashcroft, and I heard about this thing called an OFAC. I said, "What's OFAC?" It stands for the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And they had blocked the assets of a particular charity, Islamic charity.
I remember this.
And I said, wait a second, how can these guys do this? And, you know, like, where do they get this authority? So I started asking a lot of questions, and I wasn't getting a lot of answers. And my my boss at the time, I asked him if I could research it. He said, yeah, sure, sounds like national security law. And I kind of did that for the next few years, just in academic capacity. Came to D.C., ran into a lawyer I had met down in Texas, a guy by the name of Doug McNabb, who gave me my first real legal job. Met him 14th in New York, Potbelly's.
Just down the street.
Yep, I remember I was ordering a meatball, and he was ordering, what's the one with everything in? The Wreck.
The Wreck, that's the, I usually go Wreck. Maybe I need to try the meatball.
Yeah, meatball will get you a job, but Wreck will put you in a position to give the jobs. So, I mean, I think that was the takeaway. And, you know, he remembered meeting me, and he said, well, what are you working on here up in D.C.? And I said, you know, I was a consultant for the Center of Terrorism Law, and he had just picked up a couple of SDN delisting cases, people who were on the foreign narcotics kingpin list, and he asked if I could help out with those, and that was that. I started working on delisting cases, and in 2009 I started Ferrari Legal, and we started doing not only delisting, but licensing and compliance work in U.S. sanctions, and the rest is history.
Yeah, as they say. So 2009, what was it, seven years in the game now? Seven going on?
February 18, 2009 is when the firm opened up.
There we go. So tell the people, people here, you're an OFAC lawyer, you're a sanctions lawyer.
Yeah.
Describe for the people what it is that you actually do, because I don't think they fully understand, because your law and what you do, at least my understanding of it on a day-in, day-out basis, is much different than, say, a trial lawyer or somebody who works, like, you know, as an in-house counsel for Microsoft or something like that.
So what we do is actually, even among sanctions lawyers, is very different.
Yeah.
I didn't come in and say, okay, I'm a white-collar guy and I'm going to focus on OFAC.
Yeah.
I didn't come in and say, I'm a regulatory lawyer and I'm going to focus on OFAC. I said, I'm going to focus on OFAC. All right, I had a white-collar background because when I was working with McNabb Associates. So I had trial experience. You know, I've done plenty of trials, plenty of federal criminal matters. And then I had the OFAC experience too. So basically what we do is we handle licensing compliance for businesses and private individuals under a variety of different sanctions regimes, not just Iran. We also defend against OFAC civil investigations. We defend against Department of Justice federal criminal investigations involving OFAC-administered sanctions. And prosecutions, not just investigations, have been involved in more federal criminal prosecutions of IEPA, OFAC-related sanctions cases than anyone else. But we also do delisting. We take parties off of the list. And that's really my claim to fame has been I've represented the most folks. From what I understand, I think it's about 40 different representative matters of trying to bring people off the list. And it's something I've been very passionate about. What I do.
And it's for somebody like me who has dipped their toes in the game insofar as it intersects with what I do, foreign policy, national security, all that stuff. I can tell your passion. Your passion is compelling, and I think that's a big reason why you're good at what you do.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Let me ask you something. I mean, you're talking about dealing with something that is not only fluid, because the rules kind of get made up as we go, but with regards to Iran sanctions, it's super unique because here we've built up this infrastructure of, you know, the most draconian sanctions regime in the history of the world. Mm. Most of the people that built it up, in my humble opinion, don't want to put words in your mouth, never intended to undo it or consider the possibility of undoing it.
Yeah.
And then Rouhani gets elected, the negotiations happen, and now we have first country to get out of Chapter 7 without getting bombed.
Right.
So here, now this idea of how do we dismantle, what do we dismantle, what remains in place, I mean, and especially in the aftermath of the nuclear deal, people were saying, oh, you know, Iran is going to be, it's going to be a gold rush. All these companies are going to head in and people are going to be making a killing. But I think a few of us knew that it was always going to be more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And I think the facts show that it is, in fact, way more complicated than that. So explain why Iran is still having problems with sanctions, even after it's lived up to its end of the bargain with regards to the nuclear deal, as described by U.S. officials.
So I think there's a quote I wanted to touch on from a former OFAC official, and I won't blow up their spot here, although they did say it publicly, I suppose I could. And they said, you know, we don't write these regulations to address practicalities, but to advance policies.
Ah.
And this is the problem, because policies derive from politics. And really the reason why we're in the situation we are today in regards to Iran, the JCPOA and sanctions relief, is because the politics are not allowing things to move forward in such a way that Iran can actually realize a benefit from the sanctions relief, because certain laws had to be kept in place to appease certain folks. And as a result, the practical effect of the relief has been hampered by that. Now, you had a lot of people saying it's going to be a gold rush, and there's people who are pro-sanctions who are saying it's going to be a gold rush. There's people who are anti-sanctions saying it's going to be a gold rush. And both of those statements were motivated by money, right? On one side, you had people who were anti-sanctions who said it was going to be a gold rush because they saw opportunities, saw dollar signs. You know, I had one person tell me, you're too cautious about this stuff, you got to be brave. Doesn't matter what it says on the books, you know, the government, there's an understanding that the government is letting us go back into Iran. And I said, I think that's optimistic, and I would never want you to present that argument at a sentencing
right,
hearing.
You're going to go to jail.
Yeah, after, let's keep that between us. And then people on the other side who are being, you know, paid by special interests to put forward this idea that, oh, Iran's going to get this massive windfall and all that windfall is going to go to funding Hezbollah and disrupting, you know, democratic processes in the Middle East and all this other stuff. You know, I call this the boogeyman.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who justify their existence based on boogeymen.
Yep.
You know, and they get their paycheck based on what they say about boogeymen. And I feel that both sides of these of the aisle came together and created this huge sense of, I don't know if you want to call it optimism or what you want to call it, but this huge sense that, look, Iran is open for business. Iran is going to make all this money. You're going to make all this money if you deal with Iran, and it clearly hasn't been the case. And I, for those of us in the sanctions world who work on these issues day to day and who have to read the regs day to day and look at evidence and talk to bankers and all this stuff, we knew that wasn't going to happen. I mean, it wasn't realistic.
Yeah, I'll never forget, a couple of weeks ago, somebody reached out to me, a nice Iranian American gentleman,
yeah,
who was at a lecture of mine that I was giving out of town, not in D.C. I won't say which city.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting down, having a cup of coffee, and he's like, you know, telling me about his plans of wanting to consult for American businesses and blue chip multinational corporations that are going into Iran. And, you know, I kind of laugh. Coffee starts to dribble into my beard. And
yeah.
I say, do you have an OFAC license? And he says, yeah, I have an OFAC license. I'm like, No, you don't. Like, you don't have an OFAC license because nobody who's doing what you described to me that you want to do has gotten an OFAC license. And even if you did get an OFAC license, which you don't have, yours would have literally had to have been the first license application on the top of a stack that is taller than you, me, and 50 other people put together. Because everybody and their mother is applying for stuff. And the regs are so not clear and not specific that it leaves enough wiggle room so that you could potentially say, well, you know, maybe, possibly, but it also, and this is what people don't consider, leaves enough wiggle room for people at OFAC and in the U.S. government to do more than just smack you on the wrist. You didn't get an OFAC lawyer. You didn't interpret this correctly, and thus you are in trouble. Yeah. So I guess what this leads to is an actual question.
Yeah.
I mean, are you finding a lot of people getting in trouble as a result of just not understanding that otherwise, you know, not violent supporting terrorists or supporting the IRGC or supporting the Iranian government type transactions, just normal, otherwise legitimate if it wasn't Iran transactions are getting people adversely affecting the lives of otherwise innocent people?
Yeah, but you know what I'll say, Reza, is I don't think it's changed since prior to the JCPOA. I'm not seeing an uptick now, to be honest. Yeah. What I'm seeing is what I've always seen, which is people who are out there publicly talking about, let's invest in Iran, let's do this. I haven't seen them necessarily in trouble or heard about them. They could be, and we just don't know. But what I've seen, and I've represented a lot of folks, are the kind of like small players who are getting knocks on the door from the FBI, who are getting subpoenas for things like bringing their money over from Iran, but using a Hawala broker or a Sarafi that's being investigated. Or, you know, people who are kind of being harassed for some innocuous ER, what we call EAR-99 or low technology consumer goods being exported to Iran. You know, when you look at the press, and this is something I actually talked about recently, a debate with Richard Nephew, when you look at the press releases that come out from either Treasury or from the Department of Justice, you would think that they busted, you know, the biggest guy on the planet.
Yeah.
But when you actually look at the evidence and you know the actual facts of that case, it's not quite as bad as they're making it out to be. But to answer your question, yes, I'm still seeing people who have engaged in what are violations, fair enough, violations, but rather innocuous ones. I still see them being investigated, in some cases receiving penalties, so on and so forth. But you know, I mean, the thing is, so for example, this isn't a Fokker. You're familiar with the Fokker case, right?
Yep.
Fokker had a system in place to circumvent sanctions. And some of their customers included the Iranian Air Force, okay? Their conduct was so egregious that the U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon didn't want to approve the deferred prosecution agreement. Essentially, what the government did is they entered into an agreement with Fokker, which they said, you pay $21 million, which was equivalent to what they earned from this scheme, and then once you satisfy these certain obligations, then the prosecution will be done. DPA is what we call it. So none of the managers or the execs were indicted, charged. I'm sure they were investigated, but none of them were charged. And then you look at other cases like, there was a case of a gentleman I represented in Tennessee a few years ago, and he was prosecuted, charged via indictment for sending $300,000 to Iran and having that money put into a bank account, and the government said, well, it's prohibited investment. So this is the sort of thing that kind of drives me crazy is, okay, you guys want to make this big deal about we need to be tough on Iran, we need to do all this stuff, but who are you prosecuting? You're prosecuting this guy who put money in a bank account versus this company that had created a system to circumvent sanctions so they could get parts to the Iranian military. That's kind of one of the issues I have is the use of, not that there is prosecutorial discretion, obviously there needs to be, but how it's been used in this context.
Yeah, I mean, that's wild to me. Also, never mind the aspect of prosecution, because you're right, that's important, and you know that's a judgment call that gets made one way or another by a variety of people inside the U.S. government. Just the sheer dedication or allotment of resources that the FBI and others have to put out, not to get the quote-unquote bad guys, but to get people like Reza Bonnke. And if people who are listening to this haven't heard about Reza Bonnke's case, I highly encourage you to Google this man's name and learn about what happened to him unjustly, in my humble opinion. just going after people who really, I'm not going to say they haven't done anything wrong, because I don't know the specific details of each and every single legal case,
right.
But if there surely there is a sliding scale of wrong, and that sliding scale can determine what the actual punishment is and whether or not you get a knock on the door from the FBI, or if they come in guns a-blazing, which
right.
I'm sure has happened on more than one occasion.
Oh, yeah.
How do, I mean, what is the process for trying to right-size not only the expectation but the application? Or is it just willy-nilly?
No, I mean, I don't think it's willy-nilly. I think a couple things here. One, agents and prosecutors don't really know what they have until they're very far into the case.
Okay, yeah.
So I think that happens, right? And sometimes you may get a criminal complaint or an indictment file, or have an indictment returned or a criminal complaint filed, and you have an idea what this person did wrong. You can prove that they willfully did it wrong, but you really don't know the extent of it. And one of the first moves that prosecutors make in almost all cases is, you know, once the defendant has been charged, all right, is there, you know, do you want to cooperate? Okay, and what does that mean? So when, you know, I represent a lot of Iranians and Iranian Americans, and when they hear cooperate, they're like, yes, I'll talk to you. You know, this is perfect. Iranians, we love to talk, right?
Yeah.
We love to present our side of the story. But what cooperation means in the federal criminal context is that you're going to come in, you're going to say, yes, government, everything you said, absolutely correct. I did all of that. Now here's information that allow you to investigate and prosecute other people. And that's what they're looking for when they do cooperation. And I think a lot of times, at least in cases I've worked, the prosecutors have sat down and they're like, okay, maybe this guy doesn't really, maybe this guy isn't part of some huge procurement network that's related, you know, connected to the IRGC. Maybe he just was a business guy trying to do a deal and, you know, violated sanctions. And one other point on this, not to, you know.
It's an important point. You're not belittling it in any way, shape, or form.
I got an issue with the way the law is set up, the jurisprudence in this area. And the reason why is because there's a difference between a civil sanctions violation and a criminal sanctions violation, and the difference is willfulness, meaning that you violated a known legal duty. Well, the way this has been proven in cases and the way the law is developed is basically what courts have said is the fact that someone knew of the embargo is evidence that they knew of their legal duty.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't mean you need to know about what's licensed, what's exempted, what's generally authorized, anything like that. Just you know the embargo and you did this. And this has been proven in certain cases by showing evidence, well, you knew you couldn't send money directly to Iran, so you knew what you were doing was illegal.
Yeah.
This is crazy, right? Because, one, we're talking about, particularly with Iran, I'm kind of sticking with Iranian Americans here, but you're talking about an immigrant population, a lot of whom came over. English is a second language for them. They're tied up in their own community a lot of times. You know, they're not lawyers. Everybody's not a lawyer. There is some bad information floating around the community by word of mouth and through other forms as well. So you find these people in this position where they don't really know what the law is. And then they're reading news articles about sanctions on Iran are lifted. Or, yeah, the sanctions are against the government of Iran, or they're against the military of Iran. They don't know. You know, it's not as intuitive as, oh, okay, there's an embargo. That means that I cannot have a bank account in Iran.
Yeah.
There is an embargo. That means that I cannot refer a business opportunity to someone in Germany to do business with my cousin in Iran.
Yeah.
You know, but the government looks at it as like, no, he knew. He knew he couldn't send money there, so obviously he knew what he was doing was a violation. And that's really where I have an issue with some of these prosecutions.
I mean,
and the law.
It's super interesting to me, because even though I do stuff like this, I don't want to say exactly this because I'm not a lawyer.
Sure.
But I'm working on these issues day in and day out, and this stuff fascinates me. And talking to people like you and our colleague Tyler Collis, like I'm always learning new stuff, new granularity, right?
Right.
But doesn't that speak to a larger problem? I mean, like, does the Iranian-American community, or Americans in general, do they really understand the policies and the consequences and the details of the policies that their government is putting forward, frankly, in their name, because we're a democracy, so this is our elected officials acting on our behalf. And the reason why I ask this is because, okay, look, not to draw parallels between Iran sanctions and the Iraq war. You could draw parallels, but that's not what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to say is, in the run-up to the Iraq war, 2002, beginning of 2003, we as a country did not have a conversation about pros and cons, costs and benefits, risk, rewards, et cetera, et cetera. It was post 9/11 hysteria, and we went in, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
But sanctions are economic warfare. They're financial warfare. Right. They're war by other means. So shouldn't we be having that same kind of conversation? And, I mean, look, I'm not asking you if you think we should or we shouldn't. I'm just like, why do you suppose we're not? Is it less sexy because bombs aren't being dropped, or what do you think it is?
Look, I think there's plenty of conversation about sanctions out there.
Yeah.
But they're all focused on the story and the story aspect of it, right? And the story aspect of it is one of two things, okay? Either one, this actor, let's just say it's Iran, is really bad and we got to do something about them. And what we're going to do is put sanctions on them because look at all this bad stuff.
Yeah.
So you have 75% of the story is bad stuff, and then here's a solution, is sanctions. On the other end of it is, hey, Iran did all this good stuff as part of the JCPOA, and so we're going to give them sanctions relief, so they're lifting the sanctions. And then there's no, you know, that's it, right?
Yeah.
And that's where really where the problem comes in is, and I same going back to this talk I had at Columbia a few weeks ago, I'm okay with sanctions. Obviously, my whole existence is based on sanctions, right? And I think they're a very potent and necessary tool in this day and age. But we don't have a real conversation about sanctions. You don't know what the real restrictions are. You don't know what the real consequences are. You don't know who these people are who are actually being put on the OFAC SDN list. You know, I do. I follow all these cases. I've seen OFAC put people on the list who are dead. I've seen OFAC keep a client of mine on the list for 3 years after he died. You know, all you hear is the press release, and this person is so bad. I will say this. OFAC has tried to get out into the Iranian-American community. They've, you know, given people time and time again from their staff to go out and speak to folks. They only have so many resources.
That's true.
And a lot, and it's not that OFAC is controlling the media on this issue at all. They're traditionally pretty tight-lipped, but it's the people who are pushing for sanctions who are controlling this dialogue a lot of the time. And you know, instead of pushing for more sanctions, if you want better sanctions, if you want more, stricter sanctions, you don't need more authorities. Authorities catch headlines, but what you need is more money to OFAC to enforce the sanctions.
Yeah.
So that they have the resources to go after the big fish instead of maybe just the little fish, so on and so forth. So, it's just the conversation is controlled by the wrong people in this space, in my opinion. People who, you know, don't have necessarily the interests of complete transparency and an unbiased viewpoint. They're controlling the discussion on this. And I would also say, you remember the Chappelle Show, right? When he was the African-American George Bush?
Yes.
Classic. And what does he say? He says to Kofi Annan, he says, why don't you go ahead and sanction me with your army?
Yeah.
Well, you don't sanction someone with an army, right? But it just shows this like underlying misunderstanding about what sanctions are and what they mean. So your point's well taken on that.
No, it's super interesting to me. More to another point that you made, which I think is important to point out, you know, OFAC is not this behemoth that is running roughshod over Washington, D.C. and Tehran and other. I mean, it is a small office within a large department.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of turnover. Like, they're not staffed to the degree that they need to be because, like you said accurately, they don't have the resources.
Right.
And a lot of people that built the infrastructure of sanctions left, and now they're working in enforcement and compliant at law firms or banks, triple to quadruple the salary.
Right.
Basically saying, here are the rules that I made.
Right.
So clearly I know how to be able to help you to enforce them. And then if and when Treasury is hiring new people to go into OFAC, these people have a massive learning curve.
Oh, yeah.
Because you think you know, but then you get on the inside and you're like, I actually don't know anything.
That's
right. Oh, my
God.
So it's wild to me.
I think that's absolutely right. And then one more thing I would throw on it. You have new sanctions coming out all the time. Like, we're just talking about Iran. Do you realize in the last 2 weeks we've had the Burundi sanctions regulations have come out? We have new Libya executive order. We have the new North Korea sanctions executive order.
Yeah.
We have the Hezbollah sanctions regulations have come. Financial sanctions regulations come out. So Congress is like putting, and the administration is putting all this pressure, more sanctions. And this goes back to the point: more authorities, more authorities, more authorities. When really, maybe what you need to look at is more resources. because all those points you've said are absolutely correct. I mean, Treasury's had a brain drain over the past few years on the sanctions front. Kudos to those people. They're all, I know a lot of those folks who left and are very brilliant people and deserving of those higher salaries. But, you know, that impacts things. They need more money. I think they need more resources. And to your point about them not being behemoth, they're not. They're actually, you know, people are always like saying bad, you know, might be saying bad things about OFAC to me. I was like, look, I know people over there. They're actually really good folks. They're well-intentioned.
Yeah.
They got a tough job to do, right? Because on one hand, they have access to information we don't all have, and they got this very strong, important tool in their hands, and they have to wield it. And going to Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
That's right.
So, that's, you know, right. I don't envy those guys at all. They have a tough job to do.
Yeah, and I remember when Adam Zubin was in OFAC, I think he was maybe the deputy director, at that, and then we're talking,
well, he
like,
was the director, because I think he came over. Didn't he come over as the director?
Did he come over as the director? It was either director or deputy director. I can't remember.
But it was under Stu Levy. I think he was an advisor to Stu Levy and then became director. I think. I don't...
Because, I mean, we're talking, this was like 07, 08 when he's at the State Department.
Yeah.
Or no, excuse me, I'm thinking of a different guy. Zubin was at Treasury at the time.
Zubin was at DOJ, I think Federal Programs Branch, and then he went over to Treasury.
But when we were interacting with him on sanctions stuff when he was at Treasury, you know, he had not turned into the boss that he is now,
right,
where he's the guy, right? And it's super interesting to me because here is this guy that is one of the key architects of the most draconian sanctions regime in the history of the world,
right,
believes in its efficacy, is a solid public servant,
right?
Has doing his job through and through. You know, Adam's not a bad guy, despite what some people might say on either side of the political spectrum.
No, he's a great guy.
And yet he can't get confirmed by the very same people that are pushing forward not just Iran sanctions, other states,
right,
but all the other stuff that you just outlined. And it's all just political football at the end of the day.
It is, and that's why I went back to politics. But, you know, when you talk about an Adam Zubin, I was thinking about him. You know, so I haven't interacted a lot with him during the course. I mean, he's a little bit higher up than the people I would interact with. But, you know, everything I've seen from him and I know from him, he's a very, very smart guy.
Absolutely.
And there's nobody more qualified to have that position. And it's honestly a disgrace that it's taken this long. I mean, he's still waiting, but... that it's been going on this long. I mean, it's not fair to him. And really, it's undermining the efficacy of the agency. I mean, you've got to get him confirmed. He needs to go from acting into the, you know, just being the undersecretary. So I totally feel you on that. And, you know, and this is one of the, when I said earlier about politics and sanctions, you know, this battling between the administration and Congress is one of the reasons, one of the big reasons why the sanctions relief hasn't been able to be as beneficial to Iran as it was originally promised to be, you know, because the administration's between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
And Congress is not making their job any easier. Anyways.
You know, one of the interesting things about the difficulties that the administration is facing right now, that actually doesn't seem to have anything directly to do with Congress, but the political pressure that Congress will inevitably pursue this issue, is the idea of processing dollar transactions.
Right.
Going back to what we were doing as recently as 2008 with U-turn transactions.
Yeah.
The story is that, right or wrong, I don't know, the word on the street, shall we say, that the administration was considering doing this.
Right.
Somebody leaked it. They got cold feet, stepped back.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of whether or not that's true, whether or not they were considering processing U-turn transactions or not, and I'll let you explain to the people what U-turn transactions
sure.
are, because I will try, and it will not sound nearly as cool as if you do it. But do me a solid. Explain to people what U-turn transactions are, and explain why we are not able to see Iran. We're not seeing the process of dollar transactions on the part of Iran, and why that's such a problem.
Okay, so what a U-turn transaction is it's a transaction between two foreign well, in this context of a dollar transaction, two foreign financial institutions. It gets cleared as dollars, so it comes into the U.S. in order to be converted in from the local currency into the dollars, and then is remitted out from the U.S. in dollars to the beneficiary bank. So previously, as Reza mentioned, there was a general authorization to do this. Why would you need an authorization to do that? Well, the U.S. financial institution's processing of the currency conversion is actually a service itself. Okay, so there's your U-turn. It has to come in through a financial institution. They have to do the conversion and then remit it back out. So it becomes a prohibited export of service. So remember, it's not just a service directly to Iran, but a service in which you run will realize a benefit. So if you're dollarizing a transaction, you know, between two foreign companies, but it's for goods that are going to Iran, it still qualifies under that analysis. The reason why it's important in this context is because, one, people want to get paid in dollars, primary trade currency, particularly as a strong dollar. And I think what I'm hearing from some bankers is they almost want U.S. financial institutions to be involved at some point. And the reason why, not all bankers, because I've heard some bankers disagree with this, but it's almost like a level of comfort. Like, okay, if it's going through the U.S., then we know it's okay, then the transaction's fine. Because a lot of the bankers just don't understand, not that they don't understand, they just don't want to deal with these transactions. It's 100% safe, but nothing in the sanctions realm is ever 100% safe. Because you're dealing with parties that are either designated or have restrictions on them, so there's always going to be some element of risk involved there. But it's incredibly important, and you know, something I've been advocating for years is not even just the reinstitution of the U-turn general license, but direct banking relationships between the Iran and United States.
Absolutely.
And so people think this is crazy and, you know, Iran is going to do this and that. It's like, how? Wouldn't it be better to have their money here in the, if you really believe that they're so bad and they're doing all these things, wouldn't it be better to have their money here in the U.S. where you can watch where the money's going and how it's going and who the parties are involved? And if Iran figures out a way to abuse the system, which, by the way, nobody to date has been able to tell me how exactly Iran will be able to abuse the system. So that's the homework assignment for all of the pro-sanctions, Eric Ferrari haters out there. If you could please give me the factual scenarios on how Iran, not just say because they'll use it to fund terrorism, give me a fact pattern that shows how exactly they will abuse that. I would love to hear it, because people have just said, well, that's not a good idea. But they haven't been able to say because they'll be able to do X, Y, and Z as a result. But if you put the money here, yep, you let them pay out from the States, you take care of that currency question because it's in dollars. Two, it's more transparent because we have more access to information over U.S. financial institutions who are maintaining those accounts. And three, we have the ability to leverage those accounts, right? Because if we do see Iran cheating, then the funds are here.
That's right.
And we can block them.
That's right.
There are some legal problems that have been raised because of all of the judgments against Iran arising from personal injury cases or plaintiff's cases that have been brought for Iran's financing of the acts of different organizations who have been designated as terrorists.
Right.
So there may be some practical barriers there. I think there are some solutions for that. But anyways, you know, I'm kind of beating a dead horse at this point. So.
No, it's super important. And if I may add one thing to what you just said.
Please
about
do.
Having a direct banking channel, because I agree with everything you said, but also, wouldn't it be good to figure out the way that Iran moves, because you have compliance officers, mm-hmm, that are going to be dedicated specifically to this if a direct banking channel were to exist.
Right.
And these are going to be the people that they're not just going to pick some Joe Schmo who just graduated from SIPA at Columbia or SICE at Johns Hopkins. They're going to pick somebody who's been following terrorist finance specifically with regards to Iran, who knows how money has worked to some degree, and then put them on the clean channel.
Right.
Because they, sources and methods, like they already have institutional knowledge. It is the logical progression if you are trying to improve bilateral relations in
That's
any
right.
sustainable way, shape, or form. But I just want to emphasize how much I agree with you on this specific
Well,
point.
I'm glad you agree. Unfortunately, it's just you and me on an island on this issue, because most of Washington thinks it's a terrible idea, but I think most of Washington also doesn't understand sanctions. So
most of Washington thought that diplomacy with Iran wouldn't work on the nuclear deal.
Well, that's true,
so,
too.
So, you know, I think if I want to take a line from Begel, I'm so ahead of my time, my parents haven't met yet.
That's very true.
There's something to be said for that. Now,
nice catch. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, talk to me about, I mean, I got a laundry list of questions here that I wanted to ask you, but I wanted it to be also be more conversational. Hopefully you're still with us, folks. I haven't been reading off paper as I've been asking too many of these questions, because you say stuff and I'm just like, what about this? What about this?
Sure.
It works out that way.
Yeah, no problem.
You mentioned something in the debate that you had with Richard Nephew. It's on YouTube. Check it out, because Richard is a really smart guy. He is also one of the architects of the sanctions. And he went from being a non-proliferation guy to a sanctions guy because the two were directly linked with regards to Iran. So you can learn a lot by listening to what Richard has to say. And he's also probably, I would argue, correct me if you think I'm wrong, Eric, probably a bit more pro-sanctions than you and I would be.
So, well, one, I'll agree, Richard's very brilliant. I think, no, I'm actually pretty pro-sanctions, to believe it or not. I'm pro-sanctions when they make sense and you're working to make them better rather than just working to make them larger.
That's a good point.
And I think Richard, I don't want to say he's more pro-sanctions than I am. He's a little bit more concerned on theoretical threats, right? Well, we need to do this because Iran could do that. And I would be, if I was in his position or if I was a policymaker, I would be more focused on, we need to do this because they are doing this now.
Right? That's a fair description. And I actually think that that's a good way of explaining nuance with regard to Richard's position. One of the interesting things about Richard, in addition to being a really smart guy, and I don't think he'll get mad at me for saying this, if he happens to listen to this podcast, Richard, if you're listening, what's up? Back when I was a worker bee and he was a slightly higher level worker bee than I was, and he was still in ISN, International Security Nonproliferation Bureau at the time, working on nonproliferation, we'd be in meetings and he was really good at working and owning the room.
Mm-hmm.
And cultivated consensus around his position.
Yeah,
like it's such a skill to be able to do it. Like, and I can only imagine he's gotten better at it as he's risen through the ranks. Right, he was one of the lead negotiators on the negotiating team for the nuclear deal before he took the position at Columbia. So I tell this story only to let you guys know that Richard is not only smart in terms of knowing the issues, but he's also smart in knowing how to get other people to buy into what he's thinking.
Yeah, because he's very hard to argue with.
That's,
I mean,
that's the essence of politics. Politics is not foreign policy. It's not like brain surgery where you cut to the left, you save somebody's life. You cut to the right, they die.
Yeah.
It's an imperfect science. It's all about making arguments. The best argument doesn't always win. The most intellectually honest argument doesn't always win. So you better be good at arguing your position.
Yeah.
And I say all this because he is. Now, I digress. In your debate with Richard,
you
said something that stuck out to me, and I wrote the quote down because I really liked it.
Oh, okay.
You said, banks don't care about foreign policy, they care about risk policy.
That's right.
Explain why this is the case with regard to Iran sanctions, because I think this quote perfectly encapsulates where we are right now with regards to Iran and its economy and business in the post-nuclear deal environment.
Right. So the quote basically reflects the fact that financial institutions are at the forefront of sanctions, whether it's in compliance or their enforcement or, the reporting requirements, which is essentially an intelligence gathering function. So they have been deputized to help carry out this very important foreign policy mission, right? Which is either compliance with sanctions or carrying out sanctions, or when sanctions relief comes around, ensuring that this relief is provided. But you know what? A bank at the end of the day doesn't really care about the politics. They have shareholders and they look at numbers and bottom lines, and what they care about is risk policy. What kind of liability do we incur if we get this wrong? How many man hours do we have to expend to do the compliance on this? What's our risk exposure? Does it make sense? How much money are we really making at the end of the day? You know, if they're making $50 on a wire transfer and they incur potentially $1 million in potential fines if it ends up being a prohibited conduct, then you know that's a problem from their perspective. So you have now, when you deputize the private sector to carry out a foreign policy function, that's where you're treading into dangerous waters, because their motivations are not based on politics or contemporary international events. You know, their focus is on what's the hit to our bottom line.
I think you said it extremely well. And it's funny, I was sitting in a conversation. It was me and somebody else who will remain nameless, just because I don't know if this person wants me to mention their name.
Sure.
So out of respect, they will remain nameless. And we were sitting in front of a group of blue chip multinational corporations.
Okay.
All of whom either had a presence in Iran or had the means to be able to go back in, because the links that they had broken previously around 2012, end of 2011, beginning of 2012, when the real backbreaking ones came into effect, they never fully left the country. They just reduced significantly, or essentially hit the pause button on a lot of their activity. So they're all in the room, and we're all talking, and one of the ones that had gone in and kind of reestablished the presence that they had asks, what would you do if you had another ballistic missile test. So IRGC tests another ballistic missile. You know, what would you do if you were us? And so the person who's sitting across from me, the other analyst, says, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, da-da-da-da-da, starts to explain all of this other stuff. And interestingly, nobody in the room was writing anything down because they were talking from a policy perspective.
Right, yeah.
My turn comes to talk, and I said, don't say anything. The Washington Post calls you a blue-chip multinational corporation and asks you why you're doing fully legal and legitimized business in Iran, and they're calling you about ballistic missiles. You win and gain nothing by commenting on it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Don't say anything. And then you just see these, you know, these grins on people's faces, just kind of nodding in agreement.
Because, right.
And if you have to say something, just defer to U.S. government statements. But I only say all of this not to say, hey, you know, don't care about ballistic missile tests.
Right,
ballistic missile tests aren't a good thing. It's to say that businesses, as you articulated previously very eloquently, don't always have the same interests as governments. And the expectation that they should, I think, can be a reach sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
You can't also, you know, look, there's policymakers who study this stuff all day, every day.
Yeah.
You know, what does the CEO of XYZ Corporation really know about what's behind that ballistic missile test? What are the actual nuances and so on and so forth? And what are the politics behind it, right? Yeah, I'm sure they're a smart guy, but leave those decisions. And this goes back to what I've talked about so many times. Leave those decisions up to the people, the experts at Treasury and State and the White House, who work on those issues and know the lay of the land and what means what. And even myself as a lawyer who works in this area, I obviously write a blog, and from time to time I say, you know, well, maybe OFAC should consider this or that, but those are suggestions to those people. Those aren't, you know, this is what it means or this and that. So your point is well taken on that as well. I mean,
absolutely. It's interesting, and the fluidity in all of this. Because just last week, end of last week, Thursday and Friday, Secretary Kerry sitting down with Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif to discuss exactly this kind of stuff. The Iranians are saying, we're not getting what we was promised.
Right.
The Americans saying, you are, but give us some time to iron some stuff out. The truth is probably somewhere in between, perhaps a little bit closer, in my estimation, to the Iranian side, because the U.S. could be doing more,
right,
in my humble opinion. But it stands out to me like, okay, and this will be the last one, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. You've been very, very kind already. You know, when we talk about sanctions and we talk about the problems that businesses are having, and we're talking about the problems that governments are having, and we're talking about the impact that it can have on Iranian Americans or the average person inside of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that last one that gets talked about, you know, like the unintended consequences of sanctions.
Yeah.
But I don't think people fully wrap their head around it until they see it in a headline or it happens to their family.
Right.
So in your experience, why do sanctions always have unintended consequences? And then forgive me if I'm asking a loaded question on the back end of this.
Okay.
Why do we refer to them as unintended consequences when we pretty much know that the sanctions that we impose on these countries are going to cause some set of problems?
Right. I think they're only unintended if you don't know what sanctions actually do.
Right.
When you impose an economic restriction on one person, that person is not an economy unto themselves, right? So they're not the only one earning the money, spending the money, so on and so forth. So when you impose sanctions on Mr. X and he no longer has the ability to make money, well, that's going to impact his family because if he's the breadwinner. Or if he's a business owner, it's going to impact the people who work there. You know, and I've represented people who've been designated under the Narcotics Kingpin Act, the Foreign Narcotics Kingpin Designation Act, and they lost their ability to do business. And that put thousands of people out of work.
It's crazy.
And we're not talking about thousands of people in D.C. or thousands of people in New York. We're talking about thousands of people in sub-Saharan African countries or in other parts of the world that are, you know, really what we consider the third world, who need those jobs.
Right.
You know, when you designate a big business person over there, and there's now a void, right? But that's, again, I go back to this point, it's only thought of as unintended if you don't know how sanctions work. You have to realize exactly what the consequences are going to be. And I said this again in that interview or that debate with Richard. I said, look, I don't have a problem if that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Okay? As a country. If we're saying, you know what, this guy or this company or this country is so bad, we've got to do this. As long as the people who are electing the other people who are making these decisions have an understanding, okay, this is what this means, this is what this is, and this is what this means, and they don't.
Yeah.
All right, the average person on the streets thinks if we're putting sanctions on Iran, then that's going to prevent them from getting missiles or nuclear weapons or giving money to Hezbollah. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but what it definitely does is it prevents access to foreign capital or investment from the U.S., foreign capital. It cuts off their ability to bank internationally, which then impacts their ability to get food and medicine and consumer goods and everything, all right? So it has, just like, you know, this is like Reaganomics, right? So trickle down.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with sanctions,
yeah.
All right? Because everything is interrelated at this point. And so you can't just say, we put sanctions on Mr. X and, you know, no harm, no foul, right?
No doubt.
Because other people are going to be harmed.
No doubt about that. And, it, you know, it kind of goes back to that point that we were talking about earlier. It's like when we're getting ready to go to war as it pertains to dropping bombs and firing bullets and using troops, boots on the ground,
right.
Ostensibly this is the conversation that every American would say, of course we should discuss this before we go to war. But if it's financial warfare, it's economic warfare,
yeah.
We don't think about it in the same context. So if you're listening and you're still with us, hopefully that's a conversation that we can have as a country going forward, even if it doesn't have anything to do with Iran, because we are talking about not just people who are doing terrible, nasty things. We're also talking about innocent people and how their lives could potentially be impacted.
Can I just make a point on the terrible, nasty things?
Of course.
Because so I got a chapter coming out in a few months in this book called Inside the Minds of National
Plug
Security
it.
Lawyers.
Plug it.
Plug it. Yeah, this is my the gratuitous plug, but it's called Shooting in the Dark, Blindfolded with No Bullets, the OFAC SDN Reconsideration Process.
That's a fantastic title.
And so I think, you know, one of the big problems I have is people hear that so-and-so was designated, and they just assume, well, the designation is infallible, and OFAC obviously knows what they're saying, and all the allegations are true. Here's the thing you need to, another thing is OFAC's never lost in court. Here's the thing you need to understand about designating people and imposing sanctions on them. The Office of Foreign Assets Control, or the State Department, or whoever the authority is putting the sanctions, and it varies based on the authority, only has to have a reasonable cause to believe that the targeted party was engaged in that activity for which sanctions can be applied. In other words, it doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt, it doesn't have to be probable cause, doesn't have to be preponderance of the evidence, you know, more likely than not. Just, do we have a reason to believe it? The government is allowed to rely on a whole host of evidence, including hearsay materials, like newspaper articles, so on and so forth, in order to support their position. And then the courts review their designations under the arbitrary and capricious standard, meaning that it doesn't necessarily mean that OFAC has to be right, as long as they were not completely illogical in coming to their decision. And they get extreme deference because it's in the national security realm. So they have the lowest of standards. They can use whatever evidence they want. They don't have to give the evidence to you because most of it is classified and you never get to see it.
That's wild.
And when you do, it's usually newspaper articles from some blog, you know, in Macau or like Sri Lanka or something. And then the courts don't, one, under their standards, they just have to see if they can determine how OFAC came to that decision. Not that OFAC was right, but was it rationally determined? And then two, they give them extreme deference on top of it. So as far as the big bads of the world are concerned, I've met a lot of these big bads, and they're not so big or so bad. So next time you hear someone say, well, you know, they said this and they must be that because they were designated, or you hear someone say, well, there's a stringent legal review process. Yeah, there's probably a stringent legal review process, but under what standards is that process happening? Anyways, I went off on a tirade there.
No, that's Jay-Z, guilty until proven innocent.
Right?
Jigga Kelly, not guilty.
Not guilty. That's
so, look, I learned a lot. Hopefully, those of you that are listening to this, you also learned a lot. I just to let you guys know as we close off here, I intentionally chose Eric because I know how smart he is, but also he's a good dude. He's super easy to talk to. So now I want to end with the official plug. Like, definitely check out the book chapter. If you guys have any kind of OFAC or sanctions-related questions or needs, Ferrari and Associates, I'm not just saying that because he's on the podcast. I'm saying that because I've been saying it since I started working at NIAC. I've met all the OFAC sanctions lawyers. I genuinely believe him and my colleague Tyler are the best in the business. But is there anything that you want to promote, anything you want to plug? You want to tell them about Ferrari and Associates? Tell them about the blog? Tell them about the website?
No, I don't think so. I'd just like to thank you for having me on, Reza, and all the work you've done and all the work NIAC has done over the years. And I just want to make very clear to everybody out there, as far as OFAC is concerned or other people who are involved in sanctions, you know, they have a tough job. I just want to reiterate that this is not meant in any way to denigrate them or to put them down. They have a very tough job to do, and give them a little slack, I guess. And that's it. Free Max B is probably the last thing.
Free Big of Val, yes.
The last thing I would say, Free Max B.
I respect that. We respect the OFAC lawyers. We respect the OFAC people. And we respect all of you for listening. Shouts out to the Iranian-American community and anybody else that's listening to me and Eric talk about this stuff. Appreciate it, boss.
Thank you.
Respect.
All right.